Within the Eurasian transmissions I've been studying in the last 20 years, sometimes physicians came across a treatment that worked, often coming from another culture, which they could not explain, but they would still use. In the Islamic context, this was called tajriba, translated as experience, repeated experience, or experiential knowledge. Maimonides, the 12th century Jewish philosopher physician, for example, accepted the usefulness of this principle in medicine as opposed, for example, to its non-validity in the exact sciences. The idea is, we don't know why this works, but we tried it, it works, and therefore we use it. The fascinating encounter between Chinese medicine and Rashid ad-Din, physician and minister of the Ilkhanate court, the Iranian court of the Mongol Empire, that took place in the 13th century, can also be explained in these terms, as indeed Rashid ad-Din himself does. This position, which tallied well with Rashid ad-Din's Mongol patrons, allowed him to overcome deep contradictions in belief systems and dominant paradigms, and thus to diffuse opposition to Chinese medicine. I had noticed a similar type of response in a large Wellcome Trust-funded medical humanities project I took part in a few years ago, the Life of Breath Project, led by philosopher Javi Carrel and former medic Jane McNaughton. The project involved philosophers, anthropologists, literary scholars, historians, and medics. We were all exploring the many facets of human breathing. I was the token Asianist on the team. In the Life of Breath project, it was when in the realm of what the physicians classified as unexplained breathlessness that they were willing and open to listen to explanations coming from Asian medicine, which I was presenting to them. More generally, this is often the case with what is termed complementary medicine, a multi-billion dollar sector growing steadily, primarily when hitting a wall, a dead end, when all else fails, that we find openness to listen to alternatives, to possibilities that may not entirely comply with dominating paradigms. More generally, however, there is a growing understanding, even within today's medical establishment, that some health and well-being progress can only be achieved by resorting to ideas and practices that have come to us from beyond mainstream biomedicine. This beyond is both beyond of time and beyond of culture. These encounters and the dialogue, or dead ends, that they ensued have a history. It is this history that my research has focused on, uncovering histories of encounters between so-called Eastern and Western medical knowledge. But now, when there is both an interest and a need to find new alternatives, when the mainstream ones are failing, it is time also to explore the past contexts and challenges along with the present and future opportunities that this knowledge presents. Knowledge about our bodies, ourselves, our minds, our health, personal, communal, and planetary. We tend to think about medicine only as progressing, but what if, along with all the medical achievements, we have also lost precious knowledge that can make our lives better? What if there is plenty of knowledge from the past or in other cultures about our bodies and our psyches that is really good for us? Should we be taking healing knowledge from other cultures more seriously? And are the reasons of why we have not been taking them seriously all good and valid? In a recent report, Professor Sir Chris Whitty, the UK government's chief medical advisor, argued that people should adopt old-fashioned methods to stay healthy. Coming from his stature, it appears that we are now beyond labeling knowledge from the past or from other cultures simply as Quakery or as grandmother's advice. If the person in charge of the UK's public health is suggesting it, perhaps it is time to take heed. There is a medical consensus now that the main mode of fighting disease must be preventative, with ideas of prophylactics, how to prevent illness, seeming almost to be coming straight out of some Asian or Greek ancient medical text. Reduce stress, eat the right thing at the right time for the right type of person, move your body, sleep well, have a healthy sexual life, don't be lonely. These preventative measures, again, as medical texts have been telling us for centuries, if not millennia, are most efficient at group, or rather whole society's level. Nowadays, you can hear UK politicians talking about this too. For them, perhaps mainly, because it makes more sense financially. It, very simply, costs less to prevent than to cure. Indeed, for most of its history, medicine's emphasis on prevention of illness, emphasizing ways and methods to keep the body and mind healthy. Meanwhile, while biomedicine made huge strides in treating acute illnesses, it neglected the art of knowledgeable maintenance, treatment of chronic ailments, and well-being. It has only been a short blip in medical history, and only in Western biomedicine, that the shift moved to a focus on fixing particular ailments, often ignoring aspects like lifestyle, mental health, and the environment. Before COVID-19, the leading causes of mortality and healthcare costs worldwide were chronic diseases resulting from lifestyle and environmental factors. COVID-19 only highlighted the need to tackle preventable chronic ailments, as many of them emerged as underlying causes for severe COVID cases. To treat the causes of these diseases and to be successful in prevention, a strong focus must be placed on lifestyle medicine aspects. There is much knowledge that we have lost or about to lose, but should strive to keep and regain. Our MIT project will explore a breadth of notions from the past regarding human life, maintenance of health of body and mind, mostly deriving from Asia, and with relevance to the present. Challenges of the last few decades, when a shift has moved towards non-communicable diseases, are slowly resulting in medicine's renewed interest in wellness and prophylactics. A number of current trends in medicine today bear striking resemblance to traditional medicine, both from Asia and Europe. A rethinking of body-mind connections, an emphasis on preventive medicine, on nutrition, on lifestyle, and on the environment. Indeed, the WHO have acknowledged the important role traditional health has to play in keeping populations healthy, and have adopted a strategy to keep member states to promote these. What did doctors in medieval Iran think about Chinese concept of qi? How was Tibetan medicine practiced in the court of the Russian Tsar? When faced with data coming from other cultures, previous medical cultures tried to explain such new information in their own terms. When analyzing past examples of adoption of conceptions of the body and of health from culture to culture, some of the interesting questions are, what enabled that process? What were the hurdles? How and why could they be crossed? I discussed some of these questions from a historical perspective, analyzing cases of Eurasian interactions of medical traditions and practices in my book, Reorienting Histories of Medicine, Encounters Along the Silk Roads. There is a wealth of knowledge which exists on these topics in other or older traditions, much of which has been written out of mainstream history and mainstream practice. Uncovering how knowledge on the human body and health has interacted with foreign ideas is important not only for our understanding of the past, but also of the present, and may help to enhance a more flexible approach to health. It is particularly important, again, as history has demonstrated, in times of great need, when so many health issues are at a crisis. So just a few more points to raise. So the Kuriyama question in this wonderful book: the human bodies are the same everywhere, so why is there such divergence in the views of the body in medical systems? Is a guiding principle in this endeavor. So Kuriyama brings these two examples of the way the human body is depicted visually with an underlying culture, religion, and philosophy. So what do we do with such divergence of perceptions of the body? One path is, thinking about metaphors of the body, for example, and how they, so metaphors are not just metaphors. Metaphors influence the way we perceive our body, the way we perceive our health and ill health. The example of this divergence here, the body as a machine, as was developed in the Western world, versus the body as a kingdom, as we find in Chinese and Tibetan medical systems. And how these influence the way we think about the body. So the question is, can different metaphors of the body help us think about the body in a more nuanced way? Another path of thinking about these questions, or a main theme, is thinking about the various ways we can think about body and mind, and the harnessing of a variety of Asian breathing practices into Western practices. So, everyone nowadays knows about mindfulness, but there is a wealth of other such practices, such as Tibetan Chulkor, discussed here in this welcome seminar. Thinking about how it can be used for various health benefits. And then another big question is, can we speak to medics and how we speak to medics? Medical humanities projects like the Life of Breath project has given us some experience in this. But we can take this further in this type of work that we are proposing. So overall, we're looking at beyond, not just comparison, but beyond comparison, thinking about how we can build bridges between competing epistemologies. So this is the open door we are proposing, and we'll be talking more tomorrow about some of the first steps. Thank you.